Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's the value of humor in helping Americans of different ethnic backgrounds understand their contributions to U.S. culture and their relationships to one another? My guest today has been exploring that question for 5 years in a nationally syndicated column called Ask a Mexican, which can be read in North Texas in the Dallas Observer. Gustavo Arellano is the U.S.-born son of a tomato canner and an illegal immigrant. And although he grew up in ultra-conservative Orange County, he says he didn't really start thinking about what it meant to be Mexican-American until he was a young adult. He's in town for the 2009 Distinguished Lecture Series organized by UT Arlington's Center for Mexican-American Studies. Gustavo, welcome back to Think.
Gracias for having me again.
Your lecture is entitled Chicano Satire and Other Funny Ways to Combat Xenophobia. I love that.
Thank you.
Well, I should say, why does humor work?
Humor works because as humans, we allow comedians, satirists, people who delve in the realm of funny, we give them much more latitude to speak about very serious subjects. Going back to the medieval times where the court jesters, they were the only people allowed to make fun of the king, even though and they were saying a lot of truths. To today, people like Stephen Colbert or Dave Chappelle who talk about very serious subjects but do it in a manner where most pundits would never even dare go toward that. So same thing with my Ask a Mexican column. Since I'm very open about being a satirist with the column, I very much tackle serious issues, but since I am being a satirist, I'm going to be as outrageous as possible to make those points come across, and people will give me more latitude than, say, if I was just writing a serious op-ed piece for the Dallas Morning News or for a daily newspaper.
Do you have a sense that non-minority Americans are getting better at appreciating ethnic humor in an appropriate way? Because I think a lot of times well-meaning people feel like there's a balancing act between laughing at things appropriately and maybe accidentally going someplace where they weren't meant to laugh.
I actually think at this point in our nation's history, there's way too much political correctness. So people are actually afraid to laugh at other cultures. They don't mind demonizing them. Demonizing them is okay,
That's
apparently.
That's an interesting point.
They don't mind demonizing them. But in terms of actually laughing about such cultures, it's just not out there anymore. Not like in the past. One thing about America is that we've always had ethnic humor. We've always had jokes about other ethnicities, for crying out loud. You know, back in the days, it was popular to make jokes about Poles, jokes about the Irish. There were even comedians within these ethnic communities who served as gateways to the culture at large to explain their community to the community at large. In the 1840s, there was a columnist. I think his name was Flynn. His last name was Flynn, but he had a character called Mr. Dooley. And Mr. Dooley was supposed to – the author was writing as this Mr. Dooley, who was supposed to be a barkeep on the south side of Chicago, talking about the news of the day from an Irish perspective. But he did it in an argot that was very much like a leprechaun, like, top of the morning to you, and this is what we have from the south side. And so you read it nowadays and you cringe because it's filled with all these stereotypes about Irish. But in the 1840s and 1850s, it was – it was a very popular column that was syndicated all across the country. So, and nevertheless, so it made very strong particular points about this assimilation and the acceptance of the Irish in the United States of the 1840s, because of course the Irish were the Mexicans back then.
Mm-hmm. There's also the other extreme, I know, where people see you making jokes and therefore they think, well, look, this guy, he's Mexican, he's making these jokes. Therefore, I can say it from the outside and it's just as funny or sort of equally innocuous.
People can think that, but of course, when it comes to the execution, they'll learn quickly that they don't have that that latitude. And my approach to that is, people could say whatever they want. If people want to start assuming they're Mexican, make jokes about Mexican, honestly, I'm not going to tell them not to. But at the same time, you better be ready to expect a very vicious reaction or just a reaction from people, and you better be able to know how to deal with it diplomatically. If you're just throwing bombs for the sake of throwing bombs, then that's not effective. And trust me, people will school you. What I try to do with the column, sure, I try to raise ire. I try to throw, my intellectual Molotov cocktails all over the place, but I have a very specific purpose. I have a very specific reason for writing the columns that I write, for answering the questions that I write. And it's always really to try to debunk stereotypes that people do have about Mexicans in the United States.
Is it a waste of time to even still be having the argument then about the double standard?
A double standard of what?
Of humor and when it's appropriate and from whom it is appropriate.
It's still a conversation that should be told. I do think that some people, especially us on the left, we're just so rigid in our standards of who can say what and why. As a journalist, I'm very much a defender of free speech. So even if something's offensive, I don't mind people saying it. And in fact, I want people to say whatever's on their minds. But again, at the same time, there are repercussions. There are going to be repercussions to what someone has to say. And that's what I think that most people do not know how to deal with. They don't know how to deal with those repercussions. And that's where I think such dialogue and such jokes or commentary can be injurious to other people at large.
One thing that I think is really fascinating about your work is that clearly you can't take every single question that comes over the transom, but you will take on things that clearly have a really malicious tone to them.
Those are my favorite questions. The know-nothings of the world, I love you all. Hello. In the column, I've answered everything and anything. I've answered questions about the worship of midgets amongst the Aztecs. I've answered questions about, you know, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. But my favorite questions are those that have no basis in rationale. In fact, are really based on mere hatred. Toward that effect, one of my favorite questions somebody once asked, why do Mexican men rape more than white men? Which is absolutely offensive on every single level. And I know why people ask those questions. They're trying to get a rise out of me. But I take those questions. I say, okay, let's play your game. So I went to the FBI, the Bureau of Justice, and they actually keep stats on every type of crime in the country. And if you quantify it, because obviously white men rape more than Mexican men simply because there's more white men in this country. But if you boil it down to the same percentage, well, actually white men are twice more likely to rape than Mexican men. But we don't use that. We don't say, well, they're raping because they're white. But yet people, when Mexicans commit crimes, they always try to tie it back to their ethnicity as if there's something within their ethnic character that makes them go and commit these crimes. So I love tackling the most offensive questions possible, because not only do I answer it and show how inane that question is, but also, since I'm a satirist, I could have as much fun as possible and also say a lot of Spanish curse words that I can't say right now.
Please don't.
No, well, don't worry.
I think the seven words also apply to other foreign languages. How often do you think the people who write those questions in the first place actually sit down and read your column to get the answer?
I think they almost all do. I mean, I've had people write to me 2 years later, because there's a humongous backlog of questions that I haven't answered yet. And people write 2 years later, have you answered my question yet? And I tell them, you have to have patience. Unless you're an illegal immigrant, you're not going to cut in line. So just hold on. And then eventually I do want to answer every question, even if it takes me 15 years. But then I'll receive an email from somebody whose question I answered, and I forgot even when they asked a question. They'll tell me, thank you so much. I've been reading your column every single week. Became a fan of it, so I'm still going to read it, but thank you for finally answering my question. So people do wait. People, and that is my promise to people. I will answer your question, but it's going to take time, because let's face it, some questions are better than other questions.
What was your major in college? Was journalism?
No, not at all. I got my bachelor's degree from a small private college in film studies, because I thought I was going to be the next Andrew Saras or Roger Ebert. And then I got my master's degree at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, in Latin American studies with an emphasis in history, sociology, and anthropology. I only stumbled upon journalism accidentally, which I'm going to talk about in my lecture tonight. But the short story of it was that I wrote an angry letter to the editor of the OC Weekly, the paper that I work for, and he was so impressed by my writing style that he insisted that I start writing for him. And through him and other great writers at the paper, they taught me how to be a journalist, and I eventually became a staff writer for the Weekly in 2003, and I'm still a staff writer there. So what I love to tell students or people who are interested in journalism, even though it's kind of a dying profession, but that's another conversation, is that if you have a point of view and if you have the commitment to be a writer, you can do it. Because I was able to do it just with an angry letter to the editor.
How did you decide, after having not given it a whole lot of thought as a kid, that Latin American studies really was something that you wanted to pursue?
I fell upon Latin American studies because for a very specific reason. I wanted to do a documentary about my family's, not just my family's passage to the United States, but the entire hemorrhaging of my mom's rancho. She came from a tiny little village called El Cargadero. And over the past century, the entire population has just gone from Zacatecas in central Mexico to Anaheim, California. So I wanted to do a dissertation, and I figured that the best way to do it was go through the academic route and get funding, grants. And I decided to do that, and I did a small little document, a little dissertation on my family and the rancho, how they came here. But by then, I was already writing for the OC Weekly, and what I discovered was I love academics, I love academia, but their audience for the people who publish there is just so minuscule, and it's usually just other academics. In journalism, every, you know, anybody who reads a paper, it's the public at large. It could be intellectuals, it could be working class heroes, it could be anybody, and your any message that you have, it just goes all across the area. The one thing that I did get from Latin American studies, beside that small dissertation, was it gave me the research tools to be able to do research specifically for my column, which touches on all the humanities.
How receptive do you find academics to be to the politically incorrect sorts of questions that you tackle?
It's funny because when the column first came out, I was persona non grata to a lot of academics. But over the, I think as they've seen what my intention is, because what I tell people with the column, you could read it once and you could be completely offended. And sometimes I do that. I do that on, I will do a very offensive column on purpose, but only because I don't view my column, each column can stand on its own, but it's part of a larger conversation that I'm having. So what I tell people who are offended by the column, I tell people, just give me a 1 month grace period. If you read it over the course of the month, you will see exactly my strategy for the column. And more often than not, people get it. And people will even go to me and say, I used to hate your column, but now I totally understand what you're doing. Go, you know, go get them. So to be here at UT Arlington to give a distinguished lecture for the Center for Mexican American Studies, it's great. One of my advisors at college, one of my paper advisors, he didn't talk to me for a couple of years because of this column. But just like last year, he finally emailed me and said, I just want to apologize for not speaking to you for so long. I finally understand what you're doing. I am proud of you. And that meant a lot to me. That meant a lot to me that not only can I change minds, but that people were willing to accept them being in the wrong when it came to my column.
Did your family instantly understand what you were trying to do?
Oh, they grew up with me. They
know, this is old stuff for them.
Yeah, they know the real Gustavo who grew up on Mad Magazine and just all matters of satirical, you know, The Simpsons, satirical functions, and who always loved to, you know, to be a rabble rouser. So for them, the column has never caused controversy for them. The only subject that my mom doesn't like to read is sex, for the obvious reason, because what Mexican, you know, for Mexican moms, are their children a perpetual virgin? So we can't talk about sex. But other than that, they've been very supportive. And the other warning that they give me, because they see the reactions people have to my articles, what they will tell me is be careful with what you write, because what you're writing is the truth, and people don't like the truth to be told, especially when it comes to within the culture. Sometimes there's this perception that I'm airing out dirty laundry about Mexicans, but I think it's important to have, if we're going to be fully accepted in this country, then we can't just be portrayed as purely saints or purely sinners. We have to be humans who are a combination of both.
There's also this question within the Mexican community in particular about a sort of pecking order between people who are here legally and people who aren't. Can you talk about that a little
bit? And not just people who are here legally and people who are here illegally, people from different states. One question that I've written in my column, which is in my book, which there'll be copies tonight, it was an Italian man who said that, you know, why I own a construction company and I always see the lighter skinned Mexicans always discriminating against the darker skinned Mexicans. What's going on with that? And I said, look at your own culture. You know, when the Italians were here at the turn of the 20th century, the people at the lowest, you know, the totem pole were the Sicilians, the darkest skinned. Even some Italians didn't even consider them Italian. The Neapolitan folks were up, you know, higher up on the scale. There's always been this gradations of discrimination amongst people of their own ethnic groups. So with Mexico, there's going to be rivalries between, say, people from Mexico City and Jalisco and Zacatecas, and all Mexicans always look down on people from Oaxaca because a lot of them don't even speak Spanish as their first language.
They speak Native American languages.
Well, they speak their own languages, Mixteco and Zapotec. And so there's a lot of rampant discrimination here. So the discrimination that – and then, of course, the divide between the countryside where my parents are from and the cities. So all those discriminations just come up here to the United States, and then you have the whole question of legal versus illegal. We're humans. All humans just love to squabble.
Gustavo Arellano is my guest. He writes the syndicated column called Ask a Mexican. He is in town for the 2009 Distinguished Lecture Series at UT Arlington Center for Mexican American Studies. That takes place tonight at 7. You can find information about the appearance on the think page of KERA.org. If you want to join us, give us a call right now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gustavo Arellano. He writes a syndicated column called Ask a Mexican, which appears locally in the Dallas Observer. He's in town for the 2009 Distinguished Lecture Series at UT Arlington's Center for Mexican American Studies. If you want to join us and if you want to ask a Mexican a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Over the past 5 years, has your understanding of sort of non-Mexican culture changed?
And my understanding?
Well, let's say the way that non-Mexicans view Mexicans. Are you starting to have a more nuanced understanding of that?
I've been pleasantly surprised that a lot of people are just curious as opposed to hateful. Because I come from Orange County, California, which until the rise of Joe Arpaio, Phoenix, was a Mexican-hating capital of the United States. So I just assumed almost all white people hated Mexicans. And so when I started the column in Orange County, it was just supposed to be a satirical commentary on how racist Orange County was toward Mexicans. But as it got syndicated, I started receiving a lot of genuinely curious questions. People from, say, South Carolina or even Montana who said, you know, we got Mexicans up here now. They're nice people. But, you know, there's some things that I don't know why they do that. Why does their music sound like polka music? Why do they like eating chili so much? Those aren't racist questions. Those are genuinely curious questions. So that, you know, and I still do receive a lot of racist questions. But I would argue, geez, that's maybe like 5 to 10% of all the questions that I get. And I get hundreds of questions. And so that's really surprised me. And it's also it's given me hope for the future of this country.
It has to be a challenge, though, having grown up surrounded by what felt like a pervasive kind of racist culture to have adjusted that. I mean, did it take you a while to think, am I reading what I'm reading? Is this really true other places?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that culture, the way people react to Mexicans varies from state to state. Here in Texas, you know, you folks made your peace with Mexicans, geez, more than a century ago, while here in California, we're still, I mean, relatively speaking, but in California, in some ways, we're still fighting the Mexican-American War that happened back in 1848. It's just, it's an eternal struggle. And so, that's an interesting criticism of the column that people do have about it. They'll tell me, how can you write a column about Mexicans and assume that what you experience in Southern California is going to be the same all across the United States. And so that is a challenge for me to make sure that the questions that I receive are going to be palatable to people all across the United States. So if I'm doing a questions about, you know, mowing lawns, well, that's not going to have much cachet in New York where there's almost no lawns whatsoever. So I need to, if somebody asks a question about that, I need to make it in a way that's universally applicable to the rest of the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go and talk to Henry in Dallas. Hi, Henry.
Hi. I just had a quick question about the word Mexican. I know a lot of people that are from, you know, say Panama or, you know, other Latin American countries, and they say that they're Mexican. Sometimes they find that offensive. Also, the politically correct term is sort of Hispanic. You know, like there's many Hispanics in the U.S., da-da-da-da. But the column specifically asked a Mexican, and I mean that, I don't know if that has some sort of function. Like if it was asked a Hispanic, would it have as much flair? Or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also, the etymology of the word Hispanic, wouldn't that connote like Spaniard, which would sort of be incorrect to a degree?
Absolutely. You know, there's always that question, like, what's a Hispanic, what's a Latino, and what's a Mexican? Well, Hispanic means anybody from the Hispanic world, which includes Spain, Portugal, and all of its colonies all across the United States. You could even argue Angola is part of the Hispanic world. Latino specifically refers to people from Latin America. So all those countries that come from Latin America, Brazil, South America, North America, and some of the Caribbean islands, of course, Mexican refers specifically to Mexican. I can't speak about Panamanians. I can't speak about the Guatemalan experience. They're the fall guys in my column, but I can't speak about other cultures. I can only speak about Mexican culture because that's what I grew up in. And frankly, I think most people, you know, when it comes to Latino cultures, people have problems for the most part with Mexican cultures. You know, not just a question of illegal immigration, but just also culturally. You never hear Bill O'Reilly or Lou Dobbs rail against Panamanians or, you know, other people from Latin America. So just the column of Ask Mexican, even that title immediately sends flares up with people. If you call it Ask a Latino, it's a much more benign column title than Ask a Mexican. So and given that also the focus of the column is Mexican, it makes sense to call it that.
Well, I have to imagine that part of the reason that people bristle if they're Panamanian or Peruvian or whatever is that they're not Mexican.
Exactly. Like
if you call me English, I'm Irish, so I'll correct you.
Of course, that's offensive, and it's just naturally – it's natural. You want to be called what you consider yourself to be called. You know, if people want to be diplomatic and they really can't tell whether that dark tone, if that makes you Guatemalan or Mexican, then what I always tell people is, you know, ask them, what are you? Do you want to be called Hispanic? Because some people do. Do you want to be called Mexican? Because some people do, or some people, they just want to be called plain old American. So it's a little bit risky to make assumptions. Where I do criticize people is for people get angry if people do make an assumption about you, because, you know, it's not like we're all wearing badges. Hello, I am Mexican. Hello, I am a fifth generation Tex-Mex Tejano or anything like that.
You keep that card in your wallet.
Exactly.
Where we can't see it. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Patrick in Richardson. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. I just wanted to say, once again, very interesting show and a highly interesting guest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to relay this story. I graduated from high school in Langley, Virginia, and because of the socioeconomic reasons of graduating from there, I really didn't have an appreciation or even an understanding of anybody that wasn't just in the regular realm. Even the, if you want to call them the Latinos there, they didn't act like Latinos that I would come to know. From there, I went to college, but I moved out to Colorado in Aspen, and that's when I started working in a restaurant, and the funniest thing started happening. Because I grew up speaking French, they started calling me a baboso because I was very clumsy in the kitchen, and I always spilled stuff over myself. So by them calling me this endearingly, and I not knowing what the term is, I learned to slowly start to speak Spanish with this term and starting going, ¿Cómo se dice baboso en inglés? Patricio. And it would always make them laugh, and By learning that, and by calling myself that, and by not ever being able to get a definition from anybody how it really translates, at least one that was consistent, and then also reading it in your article, it's just so much fun living the life of being in the company of whether you want to call them just other Americans or Latinos or whatever. They're just such wonderful people.
What's great about his story was that, you know, you're in the kitchen, a lot of guys, so it's going to be sort of a locker room atmosphere. So everybody gets these offensive names. Rather than him being offended by it, he was actually curious and said, hey, I'm one of the boys, even though you're calling me a baboso, which literally means slug, like a slug, but, you know, endearingly means like you clumsy guy. He was able to make a connection there. And a lot of people sometimes get upset, oh, don't speak Spanish in front of me because you're obviously just talking about me. No, he was completely open. So that's a great story, and I'm glad he was able to see through that.
Where do you think that paranoia comes from? Because it does seem that a lot of people who are most afraid are really just suffering from a lack of the ability to communicate properly.
It's part of our culture. The United States has a latent xenophobia in its psyche, hardwired in its psyche. Some, you know, in some places more pronounced than others. So whenever we have a new group of people, it's always the same story. They're ostracized, even if they come here legally. They're made fun of. They're pillared or pilloried. I don't know how you say the word, in the press, and eventually they become accepted. It started, you know, even going back to the 1780s. You have Benjamin Franklin railing about Germans in the Pennsylvania Valley, saying, within a generation, we're all going to speak German because, of course, those Germans are never going to speak English. And, of course, they all ended up assimilating. And so similarly, throughout the history of this republic, we have like the immigrant group that everyone feared. If it wasn't the Irish, it became the Italians, became the Jews, became the Poles. Currently, you know, right now it's the Mexicans. Who knows? Maybe in a couple of generations, it'll be another group. Or, you know, if Iraqis ever come to this country en masse, then it'll be the Iraqis.
Do you think that we'll ever get beyond this sort of cultural hazing that we do when a significant new ethnic group?
No.
I see you shaking your head.
No. It is a very proud tradition of America to hate the newcomers, and for the last set of newcomers to assert their identity as Americans, they get to hate the new newcomers. That is the agreement that our founding fathers created for us.
So does that maybe indirectly serve us in some way?
I think it does, because I think ultimately this hazing, as you wonderfully put it, I think it ties us, because what this hazing does, at least it did for me, if I hear people say, well, Mexicans can't go to college, Mexicans can't do that, it just made me, I didn't get hurt by it. I thought the commentary was dumb, but it just made me work that much harder. So what I think, that sort of hazing, it motivates people to go up to the next level. So at the very least, so they don't get called those nasty words that they were called when they came to this country, you know, at the bottom of the rung.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Gustavo Arellano, the author of the Ask a Mexican column, is my guest. Let's go next to Thomas in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, I'm totally fascinated by what you're talking about. I know my friends and I grew up, and we'd, you know, pick on each other's racial differences, and it was all fun-loving. And my dad, you know, if you cut him off in traffic or something, would certainly hurl an epithet based on your gender or race. I don't think that's racism. I think it gets called that too often. And, you know, it's certainly crude, and, you know, he's yelling it to himself. But I was wondering what you think of that, because I know you're calling can get pretty saucy sometimes.
Well, again, with the column, it's absolute satire. So everyone is reduced to their racial or ethnic group. So and not just, you know, not just white folks. So white folks become gabachos. Mexicans, they become WABs, W-A-B, because that's the slur that Mexicans in Orange County use to make fun of less assimilated Mexicans. All Asians, whether you're Chinese, Indonesian, or Indian, chinitos. It's just, I mean, it's just really an end, you know, reducto ab absurdia, or however you say that word, game. Because again, I'm making that point about how in this country, that's how we've always had race relations. No matter who you are, ultimately, it's whatever heritage you claim that people will usually pick on you or call you that. That said, I think amongst friends, you can make fun. You can make those sort of jokes like, oh, you know, you dumb Polack, or you funny or thrifty Scotsman. That's one that we usually forget.
Yeah, it's not really a big insult these days.
Exactly. That would be more of a compliment. But I think the danger comes when people go beyond just the cheap insults like that and really attribute any pathology that you may have as directly and also as uniquely part of your ethnic group. So when people say, you know, you could say, yeah, okay, so a Mexican committed a crime, that's fine. But when you take that to say all Mexicans are criminally inherent or are inherently criminal, that's where it becomes a problem.
Can we trust ourselves, though, Gustavo, to make this sort of jokes among friends that you're talking about and not, you know, the caller just now, Thomas, said his father yells epithets at other drivers. I don't know his father and I don't know his intentions, but if I observe that, I would think it was over the line.
I think so. I think one has to question where is the motivation behind that. Like amongst my friends, especially my circle of journalism friends, we do a lot of investigations into really dark subjects, and we actually do a lot of exposures of hate groups. So in, you know, part of the gallows humor for us, we call ourselves some of the epithets that people use. That I'm sure to the outsider, they think, what on earth are you doing? And so that's always the danger. You know, our motivation is we're trying to make light of a very stressful job. But for other folks, they might be, I wouldn't call them immediately inherently racist, but I would question, well, why do you use that term specifically? In other words, I wouldn't immediately throw stones at them, but I would question, you know, why you use a particular term for any reason.
Let's go next to Melinda in Dallas. Hi, Melinda.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Gustavo, I just want to say that I read your column all the time, and I think it's terrific. And one of the things that I love about it most is that you have a sense of humor, both about me as Mexican and Mexican Americans, as well as about everybody else. And it makes it easy to stomach some of the hard realities of life, as well as the things that you have to say to us. Something I'm going to ask you to do, and that is kind of comment on the distinction between, I'm going to use the hyphenated term, Mexican-American and Mexican, because as everyone would say, there's a huge difference between those of us who are Irish and born here and the Irish who are born in Irish-Americans and the Irish who are born in Ireland. There's a big difference between Mexicans who are born here and the Mexicans that we call mojados.
Uh-huh.
You know?
The Mexican term for wetback, yeah.
Yes, and it's a distinctly different culture. You know, like, you know, we as the Mexicans born here sometimes even are ashamed of the mojados, unfortunately, you know, and sometimes we want to separate ourselves from them when, you know, they're our second cousins.
Yeah, first and foremost, thank you for reading my column. Secondly, what she said is so true. My own mom, who came to this country legally in the 60s, who still spends most of her life speaking Spanish. She knows how to speak English. She's a citizen now, but she spends her entire life speaking Spanish. She herself will say, those Mexicans that are coming today, they're just not like the Mexicans of our generation. Even though, again, she, if anybody saw the way she lived life, she would be one of those so-called bad Mexicans. She said, now they're coming from Michoacán and Mexico City, and you can't trust them because they're darker skinned and they're liars and thieves. This is a Mexican talking to herself about other Mexicans. So the distinction between Mexicans and Mexican-Americans, really, it's just one generation. From one generation, you have – my parents, who are blue-collar workers who spend their lives speaking Spanish, to myself, a college-educated, basically, you know, a Mexican-American, and then my children will be even more removed from that generation. So the differences, they are pretty stark. Mexican-Americans are basically Americans, and Mexicans themselves, like Mexican proper, are immigrants who came to this country. But it's the same difference as you had when you had the Protestant Irish coming in, and before the Catholic Irish, then making fun of all the Catholic Irish who are coming into this country and saying they're papists and, you know, they're all drunks and lechers. It's the same difference. Unfortunately, it's the American tale.
Do you think, though, in terms of sort of a shorthand term, when you describe yourself to people, you'd say, well, I'm Mexican, so I do this, this, and this. And there are people who would argue you have to put that hyphen and add American on the end, because otherwise it sort of – it belies your pride in the country.
No. I think that goes without saying. One time somebody started criticizing my dad. He said, when I told him about my dad, how he mostly speaks Spanish, and then I said, he asked me, do you wave the American flag? I'm like, no, we don't have American flag. We don't have any flag outside. The gentleman started saying, well, your dad's not a real American. I said, really? Because my dad's a citizen. He took an oath to this country. He pays his taxes. He buys his insurance. He owns his house. He sent all of his kids to college. He might not know English, and he might not be waving the flag, but that's about as American a person as I could tell. And when I explained it to him that way, the guy apologized, and I said, well, you know, apology accepted, but really think about what you have to say. It when I call myself Mexican, when somebody calls himself, oh, yeah, you know, or, you know, especially amongst people who've been here six or seven generations of Irish heritage, they'll say, yeah, I'm a drunk because I'm Irish. It goes without saying that we also think we're American, but we're having fun with our ethnicity and trying to jokingly attribute certain things of our character to our original ethnicity.
I want to talk for a minute about the skin color thing that you mentioned before. You've done a little bit of research into why this phenomenon occurs, haven't you?
It's universal. For whatever reason, it's people who are darker skinned tend to be more discriminated against than people with lighter skins. It happened in India when, you know, the Brahmin class, which was lighter skin, discriminated against the Dalits. It happened in Italy within the northern Italians, who were much lighter skin, against the southern swarthier Italians. And it happens in Mexico. And of course, here in the United States, it goes without saying what the darker skin tone used to mean for you in this country.
Gustavo Arellano is my guest. He writes the syndicated Ask a Mexican column. He's in town for the 2009 Distinguished Lecture Series put on by UT Arlington's Center for Mexican American Studies. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Gustavo Arellano is my guest. He writes the Ask a Mexican column, which appears locally in the Dallas Observer. He's in town for the 2009 Distinguished Lecture Series at UTA's Center for Mexican American Studies. You can find details about the appearance on the Think page of KERA.org. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Sherry in Dallas. Hello, Sherry.
Hi, how are you? I'm enjoying the show.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to say something. I was raised in a household where we spoke English and Spanish, so I'm equally at home. In fact, as a little girl, I thought Spanish was formal and English was casual. But what I wanted to ask was, have you ever come across people who say, well, English should be the language of the United States? I always have to bite my tongue to say, okay, number one, it is. And number two, if you're going to insist on that, then let's actually speak English. There's no such word as nuclear or jewelry. I don't think conversate is a word, and I know for sure axe, as in ax me a question, is not right. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Sure. Thanks for the call. I get that all the time. California was actually the birthplace of the English-only movement. In 1986, they passed a proposition, I think it was Proposition 14, that dictated that English was the official language of California. And you always have these movements to make English the official language of the United States. And I think it's a silly conversation. First and foremost, there's been foreign languages spoken on this country since the foundation, even outside of the Indian languages, or, you know, the Native American languages. There's always been foreign languages. There's always been immigrants who come in, and sure, they learn English, but they live their lives speaking this language. If that wasn't the case, you would never have the ethnic enclaves of Chinatown, Little Italy, and Greektown. Foreign languages have always been a part of this country. And for all of a sudden say, oh my gosh, we need to somehow eradicate them, it's ahistorical. And it's also, whenever people try to govern language, trying to govern language is one of the most asinine efforts to try to do, because you cannot put language, you cannot legislate against language, because language is so fundamental to humans that we will find a way around any legislation against language. Even if you try to make English only or outlaw bilingual education, people will always find a way around it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Kevin in Dallas. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, I am a fond admirer of your guest. And
thank you.
I have a question for him. My mother is Vietnamese, and my father is Mexican-American. And I've noted, and in my opinion, I look more Asian than I probably do look Hispanic, okay? Mm-hmm. But I have a very good grasp of the Spanish language. It was the one that I learned first before Vietnamese. And I've noticed here in Texas in particular, if I try to make an attempt to speak Spanish to and someone who is obviously Mexican, if you will, I get almost a degree of hostility. But if I do it, let's say, in the state of California or New York or you know, even Florida, I get a completely almost, oh, thank you for trying to, ingratiate yourself with us. We appreciate your attempt. You know, and then they ask me about my family. The other one, I get a very curt response, and I find that just unique to Texas. And
that's weird. Let me interrupt. That's weird because my interactions with Latinos, especially Mexicans in Texas, I find them to be some of the most hospitable people I've ever come across amongst friends or fans. They're just so friendly. So for people, you know, for the gentleman's reactions toward that, or at least his experience with that, I find that very strange and upsetting. I think with most Latinos or, you know, most Mexicans, when somebody tries to speak to them in Spanish, even if it's butchering the language, they'll partly laugh, but at the same time, they'll correct them. And I think that's much better than just immediately making a mockery out of them.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that responses to that are different, maybe not the exact same pattern that Kevin described, but do you find different parts of the country are somehow different?
Oh, absolutely. Mexicans, as we talked earlier, the way people react to Mexicans or the way Mexicans react to other people, it does vary from region to region. Like I said, here in the state of Texas, all the Mexicans I've just found incredibly hospitable. Maybe that's just a Texas character. El Paso, they're the most laid-back people I've ever encountered in my life. It's just a joy to be in El Paso. And then if you're in Orange County, in Los Angeles, those Mexicans just tend to be so angry all the time. While in Orange County, we're a little bit more conservative. You know, just like humans who settle in any part in any region of the world, you're going to have your differences.
I'm really interested in what it must be like for sort of enclaves now, and they're getting larger and larger, of Mexicans in places like South Carolina, like you were saying. It's almost like, in some ways, culturally, they're pioneers in these places.
Oh, especially in the South. The South has, in the past decade, has had the largest percentage-wise increase of Latinos of any region in the United States. There used to be nobody, next to nobody. Now there's a couple of people. And so the South is absolutely going cuckoo because these Mexicans, these Latinos, they're interacting with the traditional black-white paradigm. So now you're having people – I remember the New York Times did this article a couple of years ago about a Mexican enclave in Alabama, and the kids were growing up loving the Crimson Tide or Auburn and, you know, loving their okra and all their soul food, and at the same time speaking Spanish, but when they spoke English, it was with a southern drawl. It's just amazing. And it just shows that Mexicans were not a monolithic group, and we, you know, just like anybody, we adapt easily to our surroundings.
We have an email from Susan who has two questions. One, will your speech be posted online?
I would hope so, and I'm sure UT Arlington hopefully will do it as a podcast or something like that. That's not a question I could answer, really.
And the second one is one that I know you've answered many times. Exactly how would you define gabacho?
A gabacho is literally, it's a synonym for a gringo. And everyone knows what a gringo is. It's a Mexican term. It's not really of endearment. It's more like, oh, you gringo. It's like a white person. But I love using the word gabacho in my column because of its etymology. Gabacho's etymology dates from the, it's from the Pyrenees Mountains, and it's actually, or the Pyrenees region of Spain and France, and it's the insult that Spaniards would use against the French. Gabacho apparently meant like a mangled tongue. So as I tell audiences, I like to call white people gabachos because not only am I calling you a white person, I'm also calling you a Frenchman, so it's a double insult in one.
And you've said only gringos call gringos gringos.
That's, of course, my satirical. That was the genesis of that. That was the very first question that I ever answered to Colin back when I thought it was just going to be a one-time only joke. So, you know, Mexicans call gabachos gringos and gabachos and any other number of words. I also like the word bolillo, which is a French roll. Mm-hmm. We call you guys that too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ed in Dallas. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I'm a bolillo Mexicano, but with a surname like mine, you're not often mistaken for Latino, but it's been interesting to me to watch what goes on generation to generation with language, mm-hmm. and how watered out Spanish gets.
Absolutely. That's what people seem to just not want to understand, that the longer you're in this country, you will learn English, especially with generations, you will learn English, and eventually you'll become monolingual. One of the most poignant questions I ever received in my column, which is in my book, which I'll read tonight, was a gentleman wrote in, my family came here to Texas from the Canary Islands way back in the 1700s. We've lived under Spanish rule, Republic of Texas rule, Mexico rule, and the United States rule. I don't speak Spanish. Our family hasn't spoken Spanish for generations, but our last name is Rodriguez. Yet why is it that when I walk down the street, people still call me a dirty Mexican? There's this thought that all Mexicans, no matter how long you've, people of Mexican descent, no matter how long you've been in this country, that you're supposed to know how to speak Spanish. And some people get upset if you don't know how to speak Spanish. They're like, oh, they start making fun of you. They start calling you a pocho, which is a slur for an assimilated Mexican. I think that's unfortunate. And Frank, again, going back to language, to try to put these absolutes or requirements on language, it's futile. It's futile.
Do you think some of that, the accusation that someone is a pocho is about sort of solidarity among people who do speak Spanish and feel like without preserving the culture, it won't be as powerful?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's always been part of the immigrant experience. I don't know other languages, but I'm sure they had their own term for somebody who was losing the culture of the mother language. Because when immigrants come to this country, yeah, they're here to establish a new life, but they want to still keep some vestiges of their homeland. That's why they try to impart culture and religion and language and food. And since we're in the United States, kids, the kids of these immigrants, they'll choose some, but then they won't choose the others. And then, of course, their children start, as the generations pass, that ethnicity starts getting watered down until you reach something that sociologists call symbolic ethnicity, which is basically people choosing what part of their ethnic heritage they want to follow, whether it's just celebrating St. Patrick's Day or remaining Catholic because that's what your great-grandparents were, to, especially on the East Coast, Italian-Americans, loving their heroes and their sandwiches and their pizzerias and all their various Italian words that we learn at The Sopranos, which of course we can't say, but every culture ultimately decides who they want to be. And that's the beauty of this country, is that we decide who we want to be. If we want to be more Mexican than somebody else, somebody next to us, then we have that choice.
What's so interesting about that point, Gustavo, is that when you're several generations in, you're allowed to choose in this country. And when you're first here, someone else decides for you.
Exactly. Another question that I once answered, I can't remember what the question was, but that point was, that's a double dichotomy with immigrants, or at least the way we view immigrants. Immigrants of the past, we view them with, through rose-colored glasses. We say, Ellis Island was so wonderful, everything was beautiful. What we never realize is that those immigrants were going through the same hell that the immigrants of today are going through. So the immigrant, and even then, my all-time favorite answer or question, somebody once asked, why don't Mexicans ever learn English? And I started reading from this government document, which it seemed exactly like I was talking about Mexicans, that new immigrants, they don't learn English, they only come to this country to make money and send it back, they refuse to assimilate. Well, that government document was a 1911 Dillingham Commission report, and the immigrants that they were assailing were not Irish, because they were assimilated by them, but Italians, Poles, Jews, mostly Central and Southern Europeans. So this idea that somehow the immigrants of the past were different from today, it's a lie. It's an absolute lie.
Let's go next to Catherine in Plano. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Gustavo.
Uh-huh.
I have a great love and respect for the Mexican people. And I guess it's assumed, because I am Caucasian, that I don't speak Spanish. And I am frequently encountering the term in a derogatory sense, la gringa, la gringo,
yeah.
When, in truth, this is the United States, and you are either a Mexican-American or native-born, or you're a guest in our country or whatever. Why am I referred to as la gringa? In a derogatory sense. I never bother to correct them.
Again, that's just how it is in this country. It's the same reason why people are referred to as the Irishman, the Chinaman, the darkie, for a worse term. It's just something that in this country we've always used terms. And it's not something that's exclusive to Mexicans. In Vietnamese culture, Vietnamese culture and other cultures, you have the references to, you know, the in-group, the people of your particular group, and then the outer group. I'm not saying it's right, but that's just something that's natural to the immigrant experience in this country.
Do you see a lot of connection among Mexican Americans and Latino Americans with the Obama election, saying if the other sort of great minority of the United States is now at the top of the heap in terms of power, then there is hope for us? Or do people still see that as an other?
No, very much hope. The election of Obama was a milestone for all Americans. What I found hilarious, though, about the 2008 election was, for a while, there was this this media lie that, oh, Mexicans will never vote for a black man because Mexicans are inherently racist. And that's why 2/3 of them voted for Hillary Clinton. And if Barack Obama wins the nomination, they're all going to go to John McCain. That didn't happen. I think a huge majority of Latinos voted for Barack Obama. And even when Hillary Clinton was winning her primary battles in California and Texas, there was a stark generational difference. And people over 30 voted for Clinton. People under 30 voted for Obama. And people then asked, well, why was Hillary Clinton so popular? Well, hello, the Clinton name has been in the United States for 16 years, and the Clinton years were pretty prosperous. Barack Obama is still a relative newcomer, especially in 2008. Most people were barely listening, were just hearing about him for the first time. So it's natural that people are going to go with the incumbent as opposed to the newcomer. And I just found it so offensive that immediately everyone started repeating that as truth. Mexicans won't vote for a black man. That Mexicans won't vote for a black man.
They said that about white people too.
Exactly. And guess what? It happened.
Mm-hmm. Do you have kids yet?
No.
Okay. Do you give thought, though, to sort of planning in your head the things that you want to make sure they understand about themselves when they're born?
Oh, absolutely. I will teach my children. I want to teach them how to speak Spanish fluently, but I also understand that they're going to lose it very fast. I definitely want to teach them the parts of my heritage that I want them to learn, which is namely the music, the food, the religion to a certain extent. I don't like pedophile priests, unfortunately, and the Diocese of Orange is a haven for them historically. And at the same time, I want them, though, to have a respect. What my parents taught me of what it is to be a Mexican, which is hardworking, which is always being friendly and being very prideful of who you are and your family, and really making something of yourself in this country. Of course we're American. That goes without saying. But there's nothing wrong with me also saying, yeah, I'm Mexican, or yeah, I'm from Zacatecas, or yeah, I like my music very loud and brassy. Nothing wrong with that at all.
Gustavo Arellano writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. He's also published several books. He's in town for the 2009 Distinguished Lecture Series organized by UT Arlington Center for Mexican American Studies. You can find out about that on the Think page. Gustavo, it's been a pleasure once again. Thank you so much.
Thank you always for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.